Welcome to the Politics Guys interview, conversations about American politics, economics, history, and culture with authors and researchers from across the ideological spectrum. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. Before we get to my interview with Joshua Cohen, I wanted to let you know that we had a less than ideal connection, and so the sound quality is not up to our usual standard. I apologize for that. I did what I could to improve things in post-production, and once I reached the end of my most definitely limited skills, I posted a message on our Facebook page asking for help. Nick, whose audio editing skills greatly exceed my own, graciously volunteered his time, for which I am very grateful. Thank you so much, Nick. And now, on to the interview. As regular listeners of the show know, when we feature interviews on the podcast, they're usually with, you know, social scientists, policy analysts, journalists, people who've written a book about some specific thing involving American politics or policy. Well, Joshua Cohen, who's my guest today, he has written the book, and we're going to be talking about it, but it's definitely something very different, unlike really any book I've read in quite some time. The book is called Attention. It was recently released, and it's this just really diverse collection of essays. Now, some of them are political, and those are the ones we're going to focus on in our conversation, but there's just a ton of other stuff. I mean, history, culture, science, literature, just all sorts of things like that. And they're all put together oftentimes in ways that you would probably never expect. So it was just a really fun and fascinating collection. And I'm just so pleased to have the author on. Joshua Cohen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. And thank you for that very kind introduction.
Sure. And when I first started going through the book and preparing for our conversation, it made me feel a way I actually hadn't felt in a while. I'm a Generation X person, and so that means that most of my cultural sort of reference are from that era. And when I was reading your book, I felt sort of the same way that I felt when I first read some of the essays of David Foster Wallace, who's sort of a minor hero of mine. There are ideas that are just kind of coming out from all over the place, and they're connected in these just very different and fascinating way. And I don't know if I have a question here, actually, but I wanted to put that out there because I guess I was wondering if, you know, you have any thoughts about sort of your approach to nonfiction, maybe even my David Foster Wallace comparison or something like that.
Yeah, well, it's flattering, and thank you for that. Wallace, is someone that I certainly, came up admiring, though I will say, his politics aren't my politics, and maybe his approach toward irony isn't my approach to irony. He tended to shade into sincerity toward the end of his life, and I'm still trying to make my own peace with the idea of sincerity. I'm not there yet. You know, I see the value of irony, and I think that's frankly a cultural difference. A guy from the Midwest and a guy from Jersey, in a lot of ways dealing with also different politics. The real thing of the piece is that, I worked for Harper's as a new books critic for years, and Harper's was a place. Harper's Magazine was a place for Wallace. Came up and wrote a number of his classic pieces for them, the cruise ship piece, and most notably the cruise ship piece, tennis piece, and the thing is that he kind of that was the golden age of magazines, let's say magazines before the internet kind of cleared all of this stuff out, and so I remember kind of reading those old issues of Harper's and saying, one day I too, will be able to write 12,000 word pieces for magazine publication. And the truth is, I wasn't able to. And a lot of this book, sort of the secret history of this book is kind of coming up through a technological shift in the publication of nonfiction and kind of coming into writing really after, 9/11, 20 years old, 21 years old, and kind of encountering a world that I didn't understand, certainly not the world I'd been trained for, and trying to begin negotiating not only like the practical ways of having a career writing the things I wanted to write, but actually, you know, more importantly, navigating the cultural shifts that were underfoot, and you know, to the point of how do you write on platforms where the reader has, in many ways, been made equal with the writer in terms of, like, you know, being able to respond and interact with them. How do you deal with essentially, you know, the notion of facticity online, which is both you know, bolstered by the information on the internet, but also opposed by the information on the internet. How do you deal with things that exist outside of the scope, let's say, or outside of the brief you have for the piece, when constantly editors are pressured to put links into your pieces that are constantly, like, bringing people away from, you know, the surface of your prose onto other people's prose. And also, really, you know, how do you deal with the fact that people are now reading on the same platforms on which they're writing? And so there's always that tempt toward interactivity, or at least toward commentary. And that you know, these were all questions that frankly, you know, Wallace's generation didn't have to deal with, and that my generation was the first to have to deal with. And I'm not saying I had come to any answers, but a lot of this book is the history of me attempting to figure it out.
Yeah, and in fact, the final essay, I think, which I'll get to in a little bit here, because it's a fascinating piece of writing, seems to me, to kind of involve a lot of those things that you were talking about just there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we focus in this podcast on American politics and policy, and there were a number of essays in your book that really directly involve politics as well. The first one, it's called The Last Summer on Donald Trump and the Fall of Atlantic City, which I think that's a good place to start, especially with you actually have a connection with Atlantic City, correct?
Yeah, I grew up there.
And you grew up there, and you worked in a casino for a while as well.
Oh, yeah, I worked a number of jobs in a number of casinos. The only casino job, even casino floor job I had, was at resorts where I was a coin cashier, or they called them at the time a slot cashier. But I worked, you know, in various other capacities, other casinos, and all around Atlantic City, which is really, you know, the largest city of an island of four cities of Longport, Margate, Ventnor, and Atlantic City, and sort of worked up and down the shore. Born in 1980, so a year after the first casino, which was Resorts, opened, and then really saw, you know, Trump come in, and growing up with this idea of sort of Trump as this local, you know, this local mascot and comic figure. And so a lot of that essay that you're talking about is much about my own experiences growing up there as an attempt to, if I'm going to come to any sort of reconciliation with the idea of a Trump presidency, or at least I'm going to accept the idea that this exists, I'm going to have to labor under, you know, under its decisions. It really required me to kind of first come to grips with the kind of the world in which I grew up, and the world really of my parents, especially my father's, you know, business associates and the community in which I lived, and what their own expectations for in American life were. So the book is, or that part of the book is really kind of a study about, you know, what used to be called, let's say, ethnic whites, which is a huge category that in Atlantic City would be Irish and Italian and Jews somewhere off to the side, and how they essentially perceived their city and how they kind of ran their city as this segregated symbol of or microcosm of capital, of capitalism. I mean, the entire casino economy wasn't relegated to the casino floors. The casino economy was the economy of Atlantic City. I mean, I think there was one mayor in my lifetime who didn't go to jail or wasn't indicted. And so, you know, we had another mayor who disappeared from the job for a while. And was found kind of holed up only a few weeks later, in dereliction of his job, you know, and so it was, there were a lot of questions that I really hadn't asked myself, when I had kind of come out of Atlantic City, because all I wanted to do was get away from the Jersey Shore. And truthfully, you know, I'm primarily a novelist, and I guess most people would think that, you know, a novelist would spend a lot of their time mining their early life or mining their autobiography for their fiction. And I don't. I tend to actually mine any autobiography for my nonfiction, and fiction is sort of its own kind of closed world of symbols to me. And I realized that this was this moment that it's for me to sort of come to grips with a lot of ideas that I'd kind of taken for granted. I mean, who were these people who were around me growing up and friends with my family who worked in this casino economy? What did it mean that they worked in this casino economy? You know, what did it mean for their own sense of living in a community, for their own sense of like wanting a functional city to live in, and yet continuing to work in this casino economy while the island got worse and worse, while they moved farther and farther down beach or moved off to the mainland. And then when they saw their model being copied sort of everywhere else with the legalization of Native American gambling and with online gaming and, you know, offshore online gaming coming about, they were unable to kind of change. And so this generation of people who were largely the children of immigrants, almost entirely the children of immigrants, who had this deep concept of the American dream, were sort of involved in this enterprise that utterly hollowed out the possibility of that dream, not only for themselves in their old age, but for their children. And I wanted to couple that with a history of Atlantic City at its origin. You know, Atlantic City being the first middle-class resort in the United States. It was the place where you could reach by train from, you know, three of the major cities of the United States in under 2.5 hours. And it was a boarding house, a rooming house city, where essentially, you know, where workers could come and sit on the beach in the same way that wealthy people did at Newport. And, but this was a resort that was entirely developed as this almost picture, you know, picture perfect fantasy of the American dream, where you would work in Philadelphia or you would work in a factory in Camden and you would come down for the day. And you would stay in a boarding house and be pushed in a rolling chair by a black employee who, you know, only lives in the West Side in Atlantic City, and you would parade yourself on the boardwalk, the world's longest boardwalk, the great kind of promenade, showing off to others how you had arrived in this country, and there is such an element of theater and such an element of illusion in it that and yet when I grew up and look at those photographs, there was such an element of nostalgia, and yet nostalgia for a time that I'd never lived in. You know, I wasn't around for any of that. And I wanted to investigate what is this sort of nostalgia for times in which you hadn't lived. And I felt it was sort of intimately connected with this idea of American greatness, this Trumpian idea of American greatness. And I wanted to get at, the roots of that.
Well, you know, what struck me, one of the things that struck me when I was reading this was an earlier work by Neil Postman, a book called Amusing Ourselves to Death, which had a huge impact on me growing up, where he suggested kind of modern America was a lot like Las Vegas, you know, another casino town, very glitzy and very insubstantial below the surface. And, you know, I think there's something to be said for that. But obviously, this book came out in the mid-80s. And today, though, it seems to me that your sort of comparison, your metaphor of Atlantic City, maybe is a little bit more fitting because, you know, there's that glitzy element, but there's a certain, I don't know, a certain cheapness, a certain desperation, a sense that it's all kind of falling apart. At least that's what I kind of felt from your essay. And I was wondering, you know, am I reading too much into this, or is that your sense as well?
Well, I mean, certainly Atlantic City is falling apart. I mean, you know, up until very recently, it had for numerous, I believe 3 or 4 quarters in a row, the highest foreclosure rate in the nation. So, you know, it's also a city that went bankrupt and was taken over by the state government. The mayor was effectively, I mean, though not removed from office, was effectively rendered powerless, and things were turned over to state control. That's how badly in debt it was. And, you know, it's a city where really the most reliable lights on at night are on the boardwalk. And the boardwalk is actually the only, I don't want to say safe street, but it's the only safer street. And I think that there's no doubt that there was this, that there is this interesting juxtaposition or tragic juxtaposition between the casinos, which all line the ocean side, and then the interior of the island, very thin island, you know, it's like a dozen blocks across. And as you head toward the bayside, it becomes poorer, and you have this ambient light coming off of these, when these casinos were opened, you had this ambient light coming off of this replica of the Taj Mahal, or this, you know, this kind of Caesar's, you know, palace, sort of like, you know, Roman imperial opulence, and that the glow that it would cast would be the only thing that would light your way home, were you walking on Baltic Avenue or, you know, a few blocks inland. And so it was the juxtaposition between this, this sort of imperial pomp and then utter destitution outside of it, and the idea that you would never leave the casino, the casino confines, because you would be in a place that was dangerous. You would be in a place where you would not feel safe. That I think governed a lot of my childhood. I mean, there was this idea of, you know, you stay inside of the casino, because inside of a casino you're safe, and when you leave a casino, that's when you're like sort of like tempting the streets. And I think that's a juxtaposition that that is far more apparent in Atlantic City than in Las Vegas, which is, you know, just has much more room. It's not an island floating off the coast of America. You know, Las Vegas is, and also Vegas was built from scratch, and in a lot of ways, and Atlantic City is really built on the ruins of the first middle class seaside resort in the United States, and it was so there is a sense of historic failure in Atlantic City, where unlike Vegas is sort of like, you know, it has this rat pack kind of atmosphere. Atlantic City has almost like archaeological strata of failure underneath it. And it doesn't take too. It's not too hard to kind of scratch that, scratch away the surface layers and really get at the bedrock of it, which is that it's still functionally, you know, a segregated city. It's still functionally, it's even island is still functionally in a segregated island, and that the people who kind of, you know, ran the place, ran it into the ground, all lived on the mainland. Meaning they didn't live anywhere near Atlantic City, and now that all the casinos are closed, or very few remain open, all the pump properties are gone. Carl Icahn took over the Taj Mahal, you know, got stripped down. These properties now are just enormous properties that are rotting, and because the electricity is not on, because they're not running HVAC, it's just mold is growing everywhere, and they're truly becoming our modern ruins. And walking through trespassing into it. I don't know if I should be admitting on a podcast that I did that, but, you know, I think they have better things to do there than press charges. But I mean, these things have become to some degree homeless encampments. Anyone who can kind of slip in can slip in and kind of sleep in a room, or they can get into a room or in a hallway at the old Trump Plaza on the boardwalk. And these things are now becoming, I don't know, somewhere between like kind of horror movie sets and Memento Mori.
Well, you know, and it's hard in reading this not to take this out a little bit further. I mean, it's pretty clear that there are these two Atlantic cities, and that there's this tiny little area that's shrinking that is opulent and so forth. But even that's crumbling. But there's this wild sort of area outside of that that's unsafe and, you know, and impoverished and so forth. And I think it's impossible to read that and not think about, you know, two Americas, basically, and how what we're seeing in this country with income inequality and the decline in affordable housing and all that sort of thing.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, that is without a doubt the most, you know, apparent experience metaphor of just being in the place. I mean, you feel two Americas. But what you also really feel is this idea that the quote unquote safer place, the truly safer place, you know, was really, if we're taking that as a model for, you know, a better America than one of like, you know, drugs and guns and unsafe streets, then what you're really talking about is a belief in a casino economy. And that was the most interesting thing. It was the most interesting thing seeing people day after day, while I'm like working in the cage at these casinos, people who are spending, their entire paychecks, because the idea in gambling, because the idea is that, they're just one kind of tug on the lever away, or they're just like one chip put down away from having all their problems resolved. And in a way, like there's an element of, there's the tension in American life, obviously, between this sort of Puritan idea of, of hard work and hard work and earning and saving, and then this idea of a casino economy, right? And obviously, there were two temperance movements of the 19th century. Right after they would tell you not to drink, they would also tell you not to gamble. But there was also this kind of strange, almost religious element, almost like a Calvinist element in the casinos, where it was sort of like, I am secretly a winner, and my number will come up and I will ultimately win. And everyone else is sort of the disadvantaged preterite. But I know that my ticket is punched and that my ship is coming in. And to witness sort of an almost religious faith, this concept that I am a winner, that I will be proven a winner, and that I'm, one quarter or $1 or one swipe of my, rewards card away from being proven that winner. That was a, that was a daily sight in my childhood, and certainly, multiple times a day when I'm working at the casinos. And so the idea that, two Americas is one way of thinking about it, but I really kind of saw it as these were sort of, the casinos were models of the economy, models of the general economy, and that we really just exported the casino model, to the rest of the country, where essentially we're not going to build, mechanisms for people to work for, their wealth and save their wealth, safely, and provide social institutions and welfare institutions. Instead, we're going to lotterize the entire thing, and we're going to turn this country into one of utter luck, And of course the luck is a rigged game. And I think that a lot of the things that actually stop us in this country from building those institutions, like universal healthcare, just to pick one example, they're not really obviously, to a degree, they're like congressional apathy, or the fact that the insurance companies are have the best lobbyists, but I really think that there's something in the American character about that believes in luck. And that believes that this almost sort of gambling notion of life is a fundamental form of life that that allows people to feel most engaged or enlivened. And I think that that there is an element of recklessness and an almost a tendency towards self-destruction in the gambling community, if you want to call it that. That is the exact same I saw at Trump rallies, which is to say that the glee, the joy, the sort of like sanctifying terror of driving over a cliff and seeing if you land safely. And I saw that at roulette wheels. I saw that at craps tables, and I saw that at Trump rallies as well. And there was an element of that terror that I think all of us can recognize, the thrill of it, the risk. But what works recreationally, let's say, or what like is, it should be, available and let's say regulated recreationally is not something that should have any place in our national politics.
Yeah. Now, you actually talked to a number of people from Atlantic City about Donald Trump and his what they thought of him and that sort of thing. What sort of responses did you get from these folks?
Well, I was interested in the inside stories, which are the stories that I grew up with. I mean, these were people who are sort of living a, living this nightmare. I mean, imagine if all of the people that you worked with when you were 20 or 30 years old, suddenly showed up in the White House. And these were, I mean, I don't know what your policy on profanity is, but imagine the biggest you worked with coming up, were suddenly you know, I think my father would get angry if I named names, but were suddenly working as White House counsel, you know, or was suddenly, you know, nominated as the American ambassador to Israel. I think that there is a going back to that source was going back to the stories of, you know, who these people are before they, you know, came onto the national stage. And those stories are, I needed kind of an office to work at because I didn't want to write at home. I took a corner of my uncle's office. My uncle, commercial fisherman, but he also runs, trying to set up an offshore energy company to wind power in Atlantic City, putting up turbines in the water. And we can go through the whole history of how that's been filled by Chris Christie, but let's skip that for a second. But just in this one office where I was working, you know, every single employee had a Trump story because it's that small of an island. We're talking 20,000 people really during the winter, you know, and off season. And you know, anything from I worked as a receptionist at a neon sign company that, you know, produced things for Trump and he never paid us, you know, to we had to dredge out the marina to, you know, accommodate his yacht, and it was an illegal dredging. But we, you know, all of these kind of, you know, small grifter kind of stories. And the truth is, as with all of those stories, and it's the same exact glee that I was kind of getting at in my answer about gambling and about risk. It was, you know, people start telling me stories and there's an unavoidable note of admiration in them, in the same way, you know, in the way that America has sort of always admired a criminal. And it's a part of the national character that needs to be, you know, that needs to be looked at. I mean, whether there's the hagiography surrounding the criminal in like a John Dillinger kind of way, or in a Billy the Kid kind of way, when actually this guy's we're not so good, you know, it's a belief, it's sort of a wistful acknowledgement that someone was crafty enough or brazen enough to get away with a crime. And I associate that response, you know, which always began with, let me tell you about a disgusting thing that this guy did, that then ended with a degree of almost unmistakable admiration. That was an interesting paradox too. And so these two things, it was the death wish of gambling and the thrill of risk. And then on the other hand, the scorn that is always tempered by admiration, if not ultimately resolved in admiration. That were the two things that I think I wanted to get at because they defined for me fundamental American conditions.
Well, you know, one of the things that you wrote about Donald Trump, I thought was really fascinating. You say in the book, he can't ever gamble because he can't ever lose. I'd bet that Trump is barely even familiar with the table rules for the simple reason that he doesn't have to be. Having owned the House, he'll never tempt the House. All he can do is torch it. I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that.
I mean, I think a lot of that had to do with, I mean, first of all, that had to do with some stories that I'd heard about, you know, people trying to get him involved in a poker game and how he would never become involved in a poker game because, you know, because he can't be seen to lose, right? And from that story, it was just a reminder to me of you know, none of the people, almost everyone I grew up around, I'm talking about, you know, people my parents' age, right? Were employed by the casinos or worked, you know, as a vendor to the casinos or in some way associated with the casinos. And whether on the state side, like the Casino Control Commission side or with the casinos themselves. So as regulators or as casino employees. And the truth is that none of them gambled. Now the people on the state side, you know, couldn't gamble, and then the people who worked at the casinos couldn't gamble at their own casinos. So there are obviously like regulations involved with this. But I'm talking, they never played those recreational games at poker people's homes. These were people who really did follow the drug dealer's, you know, wisdom of never doing your own product. And it sort of fascinated me that that abstemiousness. And I always associated that abstemiousness with rectitude. And yet now I realize it was entirely behavior that was conditioned by seeing all of the wreckages of lives for which their work was responsible. And the truth is, I associated that abstemiousness with with Trump's. I mean, a man who doesn't drink, you know, how much can he be trusted? And so, but there was also some odd kind of correlation between the, the rectitude and the sense of people who run these institutions, and the people who patronize them. I mean, Atlantic City is full of bartenders who don't drink. In many ways, it's like your graduate school after AA is to go be a bartender at the Irish pub on St. James. And where the bartender, almost every evening at midnight pours himself a big bowl of Cheerios with blueberries and eats in front of the bar. I think that there was also this element of the confident man that I found kind of pretty interesting in the Trump figure that I found in the figures of people who were friendly with my parents. And this is difficult for me to speak about, and I'm kind of mumbling a little bit. It's really because I feel like this is intimate, and I feel like people from home listen to this stuff, and I feel like so I don't want to sit around and accuse all of these people who are wonderful people to me in my childhood and were wonderful people to be around in school and in synagogue and in life, and say that they were, employed in a corrupt institution, corrupting the lives of the less fortunate. Because on the other hand, they were hardworking people who were doing their jobs and supporting their families. But there was something in this split between, the person who is, who defines things tribally and the person who defines things communitarily. And I can't deny that in a lot of the ways I was raised and a lot of the people I was raised among, it was about you do the job that you do to take care of the people who are important to you. But the idea of living in a larger community and about kind of keeping the threads of those fabrics strong and keeping those, and keeping the general common weal in heart and in mind was not anything they would ever think about, another thing they would ever feel about. And certainly that was at odds with the emerging politics of a post 2008 financial crash generation.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about the sort of community aspect and stuff, because you wrote in that essay, you write about ethnic whites. And at one point, you make this interesting comparison. You say the Republican Party today is a caricature of the Republican Party in the same way that New Jersey Irishness and Italianness are caricatures of Irishness and Italianness. And I was hoping you'd kind of talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there was, there's always that question. I mean, first of all, Atlantic City does have this, very defined area, sort of, more so Italian these days than Irish. But you have Ducktown, which is, I think historic, Italian neighborhood, and it's on the exact opposite side of the city from the historic Black neighborhood. And of course, Atlantic City is by far a majority African American city, when I'm talking about these kind of parodies, I mean, it's the idea of people asking each other, where are you from? And, and if you're in Atlantic City already, and certainly if you're there during the winter, the farthest place that you can say you're from is like Egg Harbor Township or Brigantine, like you're from over the bridge. But really a lot of the, a lot of the answers is where you're from were, increasingly, as I was down there during the course of the campaign, presidential campaign, it was, I'm, one quarter Irish and one quarter Dutch and half German. I thought this was sort of fascinating. I mean, these are people who are, two, three generations removed from that immigrant experience. And yet this was the way that they were consolidating their identities now. I'm certainly not the first person to kind of point out that, toward the, deracination of a population or toward the fade of any ethnic tie, to a pre-immigration experience, that marks its last and most potent effervescence, and that's the point at which, in fact, these in the rush to hold on to these disappearing glimmers of quote-unquote authentic identity is when they become the most toxic,
right,
and the most dangerous, and in their decline, and certainly there were elements of that. in Atlantic City, where it was the resentment of a lot of those populations for being lumped in with just general whiteness, you know, and a lot of that resentment of so-called left-wing identity politics forced them to the right. And, you know, because they felt that their own history of emigration wasn't being respected. And truthfully, a lot of the discussions could be reduced, in my mind, to a historical dispute about what is the story of America, right? If you had to pick one, is it a story of immigration or is it a story of slavery? And in many ways, you know, and of course, you know, one should strive to make it both, you know, but in many ways, this became a zero-sum game in the minds of at least, you know, Atlanta County electorate, who I would suppose would have voted totally against Trump for having completely gutted their town. Instead, he managed to make them forget his bankruptcies and his gutting of the town and appeal to their fears about being, quote unquote, racially outnumbered.
You know, the one thing you mentioned about Trump and his ability to get people to believe in sort of this, in his expertise, I guess, in a way. You make that in the next essay, actually, which is called Notes on a Concession. You make some interesting comparisons between Donald Trump and Barack Obama, at least, I guess, in the way that you think a lot of Trump supporters would, right? Trump is this man of action where Obama is this sort of egghead and Trump is this guy from Queens and, you know, Obama's hanging out at Davos with the global elites and maybe most specifically Trump being this massively successful businessman. He's made things and created jobs and, you know, generated economic prosperity. Whereas of course, you know, Obama's just been a government worker essentially who's never made anything in his entire life. Where do you think that comparison goes off the rails, or those comparisons?
Well, I mean, I think it was more of a less of a comparison than a contrast, right?
Okay,
the idea of a quote unquote man of words and a quote unquote man of action. You know, when actually, Trump's actions are completely impotent, and you know, and in many ways, Obama is a man of actions for better or worse. You know, and I think that. At the heart of that is a classic American know-nothingism. It's a mistrust of an elite. It's a mistrust of an intelligentsia, and it's really, you know, I mean, this is a country founded on anti-aristocratic or anti, you know, classist notions, and really nothing has changed from the real kind of second great awakening religious revival of know-nothingism until now. And I really see that the idea of education being a marker of wealth, you know, obviously still obtains. In fact, obtains more than ever with the price of college these days and with the amount of debt that people are, you know, are bringing on themselves to attend. And so I think that there is a great resentment, but also there's a great resentment of the bad faith that most people feel is inherent, or most of the Trump voters, let's say, feels inherent in intellectual life, you know, and in a lot of ways, it's the phrasing that that Trump is constantly undermining. I mean, his ideas of repetition. Right, and his constant reverberation of certain phrases and certain slogans are really they're not just like neurolinguistic programming techniques to get people to repeat them. They also point out because they lodge in memory the sort of bad faith of traditional political rhetoric. Which is to say, when Trump is saying something, even when he's saying something quote unquote coded, it's never coded in a way that's like in any way difficult, and everyone sort of knows exactly what he means, and it's that idea of I don't care if what you mean is positive or negative, I don't care if what you mean has a, you know, this political impact or this political impact, I just want to know what you mean, and I think that there is a kind of a sick admiration, you know, in that. and a sick admiration that his followers have for that. And I also think that there's a strange shift, especially if you look at some of the rhetoric regarding the Electoral College, which is what I talk about in that essay. You know, the idea that it's the Electoral College that puts them over the edge, and not necessarily the popular vote, right? And it's the Electoral College that wins the presidency. And if you look at a lot of the rhetoric around the Electoral College from Trump partisans, from Breitbart and from other and people farther afield, it's the idea of, you know, how do these people who are, you know, almost in an authoritarian way, like, you know, men of the soil, certainly not men of words, right? And not men of much intellectual aspiration, how are they celebrating a victory that is essentially within a college that is that was founded to ensure that only the educated elite landowners voted, and that was actually instituted to ensure that the ultimate say in the presidency was in the hands of people who could read, had read pretty well and widely, and were competent to make a decision. I mean, it's the entire way. It's that entire Alexander Hamilton idea of you know, the citizens from the mass who, I'm going to screw up the quotes, I'm doing it from memory, but are the most likely to possess the information and discernment, right? And so it was this dissonance that I had in mind while writing that piece. It was sort of, you win by the mechanism of the elites while condemning the elites. And I wanted to kind of dig into the Hamiltonian notion of what does it mean to have this sort of discernment, and of what does this discernment consist, and to go back into, you know, some of the Federalist Papers and some of Hamilton's more minor writings, and figure out, like, what is this yearning for an aristocratic discernment in the heart of the revolution? And frankly, a lot of it has to do, besides with, you know, Hamilton's own personality and biography, which I guess, you know, is now famous from a musical. I think a lot of it, you know, has to do with a, you know, congenital American mistrust of the crowd that has always been a secret buried history.
You know, I want to sort of change gears a little bit. Well, maybe radically, some people would say, because another political essay that you write is Exit Bernie. And I guess I'll call it a personality study of a sort of Bernie Sanders and his appeal. And Bernie Sanders is hardly an anti-intellectual, know-nothing sort of person. I mean, you call him somebody with the rhetorical range of a CPA who spends his lunch break counting heart pills or jelly beans. I mean, I can't think of a more, on the surface at least, anti-Trump type of character. So, I mean, and you could make the argument, certainly, that if not for the sort of decades of Clintons in the Democratic Party and their deep involvement, that Bernie Sanders could very well have been the nominee. So how do you explain Bernie Sanders' appeal in this world that Donald Trump seems to be bestriding like a colossus?
Well, I mean, I think that, I mean, you know, I mean, the similarities between the two have been well remarked upon, which is like, you know, a similar kind of impatience and a bluntness. However, the difference is that, you know, Sanders is the truth teller, or at least truthful, and you know, Trump is not. It's not necessarily the similarities that interests me. It was sort of it was the fact that Sanders had such positive polling, right, among the very people who voted for Trump, and yet all the rhetoric surrounding Trump with regard to his supporters' racism and anti-Semitism. And it was the question that I wanted to ask with that essay, which was, you know, how could so many people who later were in the tank for Trump, seemingly also in the tank for Bernie, and would have, you know, voted for Bernie Sanders had he been the nominee, and yet there was this atmosphere that was either, you know, real or exaggerated by media, or some confluence of the two, that put these people out, that put a lot of these Trump voters out as anti-Semites. I simply didn't believe it, you know, and I didn't believe that the things that you saw at, like, the Charlottesville, right, are things that are really opinions that are deeply held by the entire the entirety of the people who voted for Donald Trump. But yet I was interested in this, and Sanders would have been the first Jewish president. And I was particularly interested. I mean, I think it was in the debate in Milwaukee, where they asked Sanders a very direct question, which is to say, like, don't you feel bad for running in this race? Don't you feel that you're in some way thwarting history, meaning that you are, you know, blocking the election of the first female president of the United States? And Sanders has this very coy remark where he says, you know, from a historical point of view, somebody with my background, somebody who spent his entire life taking on the big money interests, I think a Sanders victory would be of some historical accomplishment. And you know, that to me was this ultimate coded utterance to be read to be his own assertion that there is something important and there is a milestone to be marked with the election of the first Jewish president, but yet his desire to never say that directly. And that was the only moment or the only aspect of Sanders' entire life in which he is not forthright and blunt. And I'm including his policies on guns, which don't always make people on the left happy. You know, I'm including some foreign policy ideas, which has certainly not made certain people on the left happy. But the one thing that he has not been forthright about is essentially his relationship to at least an identity that that many people tagged him with, right? And certainly that he was raised in. And I wanted to kind of bring up then a history of democratic socialism, or if you want, just socialism, the American variety, as a corollary to Jewish history, because I thought that was something that is only spoken about in a tiny part of the academy, and is not something that is, so it's not something that, you know, the average voter knows, but also it's not something that even in the academy is related to contemporary, let's say, trends in identity politics or the way in which people like perceive their life now. And so a lot of that piece was sort of a history of where this socialism comes from, which in my view comes from an outgrowth of the attempt to deal with the Enlightenment era assimilation opportunities available to Jewry throughout Europe, and the idea of, you know, how does one become like the Gentiles? How does one become like the others? And it's really it's really through a process of making everyone like unto one another through socialism, you know, and that is the ultimate sort of equalizing force, and that the government sort of will grant that identity to everyone, and by doing so will dissolve non-governmental identities, ethnicities, races, and it's a beautiful utopian kind of theory or hope. But I wanted to trace it within the context of Jewish history.
Well, and, you know, another thing that you brought up that's obviously closely related to this in the essay is you point out something that I can't believe I didn't see at all, and I don't know how I feel, I don't know, sort of dense, but that the first Jewish candidate to get this far was somebody who based his fundamental platform on economic issues. And, of course, that brings in, you know, I mean, I would say a very fraught area, given, you know, the history and of anti-Semitism and beliefs about Jews and money and that sort of thing.
Sure.
And it was, maybe it's because I'm a Midwesterner, I don't know, but it was an angle that just never really even occurred to me before, but it was right there.
Yeah. I mean, one of the, you know, I understand that it's something that's difficult for a lot of people to talk about. Right, but the entire correlation of world jewelry with money and with banking is this medieval concept of essentially limiting Jews to certain trades. You know, they can't own land, they can't they can't participate in certain trades, so they're forced to become money lenders. And there's no doubt that after, you know, centuries of this money lending occupation, in which you know, Jews were demonized by the church and were sort of forced, because they were outside the church, they were allowed to lend, you know, money in certain ways that the church wouldn't allow, right? From people within its own community. After hundreds of years of this essentially forced occupation, with the Enlightenment, which is the first time, you know, in Austria-Hungary, for example, when they begin getting the permission to move out of ghettos and stop wearing, you know, following the sumptuary laws of wearing certain clothing, but they can now, you know, wear whatever clothing they want, and they can live in parts of town that they previously couldn't live in before, and they could attend university in larger numbers, and they could, you know, so on and so forth. You know, one of the first major political outgrowths from this, you know, even before this, like before nascent Zionism, is really this idea of socialism, and a lot of it founded on principles of economic justice, because of course it becomes an anxiety, it becomes a culture-wide or an endemic culture anxiety, the relationship between Jews and money, that within the Jewish people itself feels that they need to come up with a response to, like on a subconscious level, that, you know, and that response emerges as socialism, and I don't say that's a response to in many ways, certainly in Marx's way, who was deeply self-hating, was a way of proving to the people around him that he was a hated race. He was not one of the accursed people. And I think that understanding these things as symptoms of historical trauma are pretty fascinating. In the same way that I think understanding the Sanders' own use of these things is pretty fascinating. I mean, his whole idea of, I forget, what does he always say, Denmark, or, you know, what socialist country does he always point
right.
to?
Yeah, uh-huh.
You know, to say that, I think, you know, his just like he has a very ahistorical model of, you know, the history of socialism in the United States, or the history of world socialism, I think he has an ahistorical model of the history of democratic socialism in Europe. I mean, the truth is that the reason why, you know, a lot of those European countries who have you know, democratic socialism today, and the social welfare nets are straining under that, of course, was because, you know, America rebuilt these economies, and a lot of that's being a socialist democrat after the Second World War. And in a sense, America built, you know, the economies abroad that it couldn't build at home because they were building over there from scratch. And I think that, and I think when Sanders sort of omits, you know, true history from his, you know, from his economic theories, I think he radically oversimplifies at least the processes by which people, you know, meaning whole cultures, reach certain consensuses, you know. I think he tries to find in evolutionary socialism those same things that revolutionary socialism imposed at the point of the gun. And I don't always think that those things are possible.
Right. Yeah. That's a connection that I just never really had made, which is what I found so fascinating about that particular essay. I want to close by talking a little bit about, well, the two essays that sort of bookend your collection. The first one is very short, not even 6 pages, Distraction. And the other one is Attention, A Short History, in my copy around 145 pages, much longer. And, you know, what I do when I prepare for interviews is I underline things and try to find connections and that sort of thing. And that's what I did when I was reading Attention. But it wasn't too long before I felt like, well, kind of the way I felt when I was reading War and Peace for the first time, and I mean that in a good way, but I just felt just there was so much coming at me, and I just felt like the way to approach this essay was really to just kind of let it wash over me in a way, because there's so much going on. I mean, you take us through millennia in this essay, history, philosophy, invention, science, you know, and there's just so much packed in there. And so, again, I don't necessarily have a question here, but I was hoping you could talk a little bit about why, you know, you chose that approach to write about Attention, and maybe some of the conclusions that you came to in doing that, in writing that essay.
Well, I just, you know, I think partially it's a generational thing. It's growing up and kind of being told, you know, why don't people, you know, read as much? Well, they don't have the attention, you know, they're too distracted. And it's hearing these words that are, you know, used in contexts that are entirely technologically determined, which is to say, you know, the internet has made us more distracted. You know, I'm unable to pay attention because of the internet, et cetera, et cetera. Like these technological definitions and valuations of our attention span made me sort of ask what this was, because it seems very abstract to me. You know, was this a function? Was this a property? Was this a mode of correct behavior? And then when you go and look at it, you know, it becomes a word that's used. I mean, it's used in countless ways throughout history, right? I mean, there's attention that is a spiritual principle, right? That is certainly tied with ideas of moral rectitude. There is attention as a as a psychometric principle, meaning, you know, we're measuring your response times to things and the limitations of human perception, you know, in order to, like, you know, best make machines that can help humans, you know, like, look deeper into a cell or look deeper into the cosmos, or at the same time make machines that, you know, that are like addiction devices and keep you, you know, and keep you riveted. So it was all of these definitions of attention from Augustine, you know, to through to William James, the rationalists, through the occasionalists. It was this understanding that this idea meant so many different things to so many different people that in a way it's bringing it back now is essentially like a reincarnation of this perennial word superstition. And I came to this idea that maybe attention is just this sort of superstition. It's a quality that nobody can really precisely define except in its lack. And then you sort of advertise its lack and make everyone feel ashamed of lacking it. And then in order to sell them things or in order to exert social control. And a lot of that was seen through the history of a much younger word than attention, which is distraction. Distraction is we're talking like, you know, 17th century, as opposed to attention, which was roots go back much farther. And distraction was always this, you know, all of these words that are negations, like distraction, you know, tend to be, you know, not only younger, but also tend to be words I found of to a degree have these feelings or moods of social control. You know, distraction was used essentially to talk about a rebellious or renegade populace that wouldn't be brought, that refuses to be brought in line. You sort of accuse them of being distracted in order to kind of bring them closer to your agenda and to make them and to sort of inculcate, you know, better social behavior. And you see a lot of that, the distracted state of the colony, you know, distracted the Union on the eve of civil war. And it is essentially someone who won't think correctly about the correct thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And because they're not thinking correctly about the correct thing, you know, they are distracted. I mean, the real first use of this was actually with women during witch burning episodes. You know, I mean, Salem being the most famous, it was the women were distracted into witchcraft. Was one of the ways that Hawthorne's ancestor put it. The Hawthorne in his Chronicle of Salem Witch Trials. And so the notion of attention sort of being this, being this non-entity that's really used to sort of to create an artificial scarcity in order to guilt someone into seeking some remedy of control, and then distraction being this accusation of ignoring the right or true principle and the right or true thinking about the right or true principle. Showed me that these words were actually subtle, or maybe not so subtle, mechanisms of social control. And I wanted to reinvestigate them that way because I think that that they are too easily, too often used as excuses to I'm unable to pay attention. I'm too distracted. I think that by giving someone a word, you're giving them an excuse. I think that too often we use these excuses from actually engaging with the true subjects that are out there, and that we all have the capacity to engage.
Yeah, and like I said, it made me, I thought I had a pretty good grasp of attention and distraction, but it was from a very, what your essay made me realize, both of them, was from a very narrow sort of 21st century technocratic, if you will, scientific standpoint, and it just really opened up an entirely new way of looking at this concept to me. And really the whole book was full of things like that. And so listeners, I can't recommend it highly enough. It's a great book. And Joshua Cohen, I just want to thank you so much. I had a great time talking to you. Thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. Support from listeners just like you is what keeps the show going. And we truly do appreciate it. If you're interested in joining our great group of Politics Guys supporters, you can go to politicsguys.com and click on the Patreon or PayPal links you'll see there. And if you want to support the show without spending anything, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Pocket Cast, Stitcher, or whatever other podcast app you use. Share this episode with your friends and followers, and pass along our new show posts and tweets on Facebook and Twitter. Leaving reviews and ratings on iTunes also helps. If you've got a question, comment, correction, or just a random thought you want to share with us, you can reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. Our Facebook page, where you can message us and where we post things throughout the week, is facebook.com/politicsguyspage. We're also on Twitter @politicsguys. The executive producers of The Politics Guys are Michael Baranowski, Jay Carson, Trey Orndorff, and Bruce Johnson. Today's show is produced by Michael Baranowski. We'll be back with a new show on Saturday. We hope you'll join us.